The Tom Woods Show, episode 949.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, you were a victim of educational malpractice when you were in school. Well, learn the history and economics they didn't teach you at mylibertyclassroom.com. And save yourself some smackers by checking out my coupon page, libertyclassroom.com/coupons. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm talking today to Bob Merry, who's the author of an interesting article called What If Trump Fails? And he lays out the scenario that's likely to unfold if Trump were to be removed or be spectacularly unsuccessful. And it's not a pretty picture. So it's not like we're faced with a whole bunch of wonderful prospects here. Prospects are all pretty grim. And one grim prospect is a resurgent left, a very, very powerful and increasingly extreme left, which is what he thinks would be the result of a Trump failure or removal. So rather sobering analysis, but one that's very much worth reading, and we'll link to it on the show notes page. Bob Merry worked as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal for 12 years. He subsequently became managing editor of Congressional Quarterly until he was promoted to executive editor, followed by president and editor-in-chief for 22 years. In 2011, he became editor of The National Interest, and he is now the editor of the American Conservative magazine. Later this year, 2017, his next book will be released by Simon & Schuster. It's President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
This article of yours, I meant to read it, and then Paul Gottfried said I had to read it, and I did, and I agree with 99.9% of it, and I just want to discuss it with you. There are some people who are extremely anti-Trump, who are libertarians or who are more generally left liberals, and particularly the left liberals would love nothing more than to see him out of office. But there are also the never Trumpers out there on the conservative right, in the conservative movement, who I suspect would rather like to see him go as well, because they think, well, we would get a fairly conventional right of center GOP guy, Mike Pence, and he would steer the ship of state to the right way. But you see it quite differently. If we got rid of Trump, it wouldn't be that we'd now have a nice, calm Mike Pence running the show. Instead, the left would have gained a tremendous momentum, more than it's had in a long time. So let's hear your case for that.
Well, first of all, I don't think we're in calm waters. I think the country is in very roiled waters. And I think the reason for that is that the old status quo has essentially crumbled. And Trump's election reflects that. So if you sort of look ahead and say, well, if Trump falters, we're not going back to the status quo. The country has basically moved itself beyond that. And so what's going to happen? I have in this piece, I think, six propositions that sort of add up to the likelihood that if Trump falters, the greatest possibility will be a highly liberal, probably socialistic, European-style democratic socialism from our Democratic Party will prevail. And I don't want that, and most of your listeners, I'm sure, don't want that, but I think that's a very strong possibility.
Well, before we go into your different points, I want to ask you something that I asked Paul. It seems that although the Democrats would love to talk a good game about getting rid of Trump just to keep him off balance, in a way, he's a boon to them. I mean, MSNBC, for example, is flourishing like never before. I am sure that donations to left liberal causes are exploding. And the Democrats, despite their narrow defeats in some elections this year, I think are still in a fairly strong position because they can keep people agitated about how terrible Trump is, whereas Pence is such a bore. That's what I meant by calm. I meant if you had Pence in charge, it would be conventional politics again. Why would the Democrats want conventional politics? They want Trump to keep their base agitated. Why would they want to take him out?
Well, they want to take him out because they want to take out any Republican. They particularly find him odious, largely because he's moving the country in directions, in some ways, or at least trying to, not very effectively in my view, in directions and areas that they just can't abide. This speech in Poland, in Warsaw, where he talked about Western civilization, I mean, I've never seen anything like this, where the West actually rose up in many instances. Jim Fallows at The Atlantic, Peter Beinart at The Atlantic, and essentially decried any mention of Western civilization or our civilization or the West. That's amazing development in American politics. And Trump is the first president in a long time who stood up and talked about the West. So they want to get rid of him. And they feel that if they do get rid of him, they will be in a position to pick up the marbles. And my piece suggests that, yes, indeed, there will be an opportunity for them to pick up the marbles because of how presidential politics works. You know, this is not a sophisticated form of communication, this our system of selecting our leaders. Every 4 years, we go to the polls, and preparatory to that, the politicians stand up. It's kind of a communication of ducks and drakes, and it goes back and forth. A politician says something, he tries to assess what the response is. If the response is favorable, he goes in that direction. If not, he tries something else. And ultimately, the American people have developed a comfort level with that system. And if the current president or the current presidential party, if the president isn't on the ballot, has faltered, has failed, has let down the American people, they turn to the alternative. And that means that we go back in our two-party system between the Republicans and the Democrats. And when the Democrats fail, as Obama did in his second term, I think he succeeded mildly in his first term, and he failed mildly in his second term. They turn to the Republicans. And when the Republicans fail, as they did in George W. Bush's second term, they turn to the Democrats. That's what we're likely to see if Trump fails. I'm not predicting it, but I'm not seeing a lot of evidence that he's going to be able to put this together.
You mentioned the speech in Poland. I found that extremely interesting because it seems like just yesterday that everybody understood that references to faith and family and maybe even Western civilization are just platitudes that can be found in any politician's speech. So it's so interesting that our culture has moved so far to the left that even when you make almost throwaway references occasionally to these things, this is interpreted as sinister signaling to your alt-right buddies. It's bizarre.
It's the dog whistle thesis.
Just crazy.
That you basically are in favor of some kind of white supremacy.
So let me ask you then. I can see the thesis that the Democrats, could have a lot of momentum. Let's say if there were no Trump left, or if Trump was a big failure. But what's to stop them from nominating a Hillary Clinton clone, and that we would just get more basically corporate left liberalism for a while? What makes you think? And because I think from your column, you're kind of suggesting maybe the Bernie Sanders wing in particular would be energized by this. Why is that the case?
Well, the party elites would want nothing more than to get some kind of a Hillary Clinton type person in there. That's what they'll try to do, just as they did with Hillary Clinton when they basically tilted the playing field. But what I'm saying in this piece, and what I believe, is that the country is really in an unsettled situation, and it's unsettled because both the domestic political status quo and the international geopolitical status quo have both begun to crumble. In fact, they're in progressive crumbling right now, and the politicians are always the last people to get this because they are so invested in the status quo. They can't get it. They can't see it. They refuse to see it. But the American people see it. And that's why they turned to Trump. I mean, just think of what happened in the Republican Party. You had all those candidates, all those conventional candidates, Jeb Bush. Everyone said, well, he's his to lose, which I kind of hate that phrase because it's so ridiculous, actually. But nevertheless, he's got the money. He's got the family connections. He's got the name, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if it's not him, it'll be Marco or it'll be somebody. And then this guy Trump comes out of nowhere. He's disgusting in some of his rhetoric and some of his behavioral patterns, it appears. And yet the American people said, well, he's the only guy who's talking like he understands that we've got to move into a new direction. And so he basically blew away all those other candidates. That's what's going to happen in the Democratic Party in 2020, I believe.
You say that, and there's no doubt about this, that there are a lot of Republicans out there who think that once this anomalous Trump is out of the way, we'll just go back to the old GOP, the way we used to be before Trump. We'll just pretend this unfortunate incident never occurred, and we'll just carry on as before. We'll just have some Marco Rubio-like guy who repeats a lot of slogans and talking points, and we'll go from there. Why is that not a plausible approach?
Well, it ignores, I think, or it doesn't take into account sufficiently what happened in 2016. I think that the voters, not the party establishment, certainly, the party establishment was aghast, but the voters basically said, we're tired of this. This is old style politics. One of the reasons we're in this crisis, and part of our crisis is it's a crisis of political deadlock, is because both parties are ossified in their traditional thinking. And we have reached a point where neither one can get an upper hand because there's no major consensus for the old politics in either party. So the result of that, and just consider this, this is really rather significant. The result of that is that we are on a knife edge of politics in our country. You know, Trump didn't get the popular vote, as everyone knows. He lost it by 2.1 percentage points. And Obama won re-election with only 3.9 percentage points. George W. Bush won re-election in 2004 by 2.4 percentage points. He won his election, or actually he lost in the popular vote, but he won his election. But the separation was one half of a percentage point between George W. Bush and Al Gore in 2000. This tells you something. It tells you that the country is really on a knife's edge, and we can't move forward because we are at this political parity. And American people understand, the voters of both parties understand, that we need new kinds of politics. We need to create new coalitions with new political dialectics, new clusters of issues that bust up this deadlock. And we're not going to get it from these status quo politicians. So I just think that those days are gone. So that question can come up, and it will come up between now and 2000. And that's where the analysis will be. And that's where the major political journalists will be. And all the polls and the politicos will be analyzing it in terms of the conventional old fashioned status quo politics, but it's dead. And 2016 proved it in the Republican Party. 2020 is going to prove it in the Democratic Party. And at some point, we're going to get a successful president who is going to have a new breed of politics that's going to be able to bust up the old deadlock and move the country forward.
You write in the article, any Democratic politician who hopes to have a chance at the nomination in 2020 will have to break with the old politics of identity, pandering, and condescension toward middle Americans. He or she will have to start with the daunting task of recapturing the American working class, still the bedrock of today's politics. Well, I think given Hillary's performance, given how uninspiring and awful of a person and candidate she was, her results were actually not bad in terms of sheer votes. They were not bad given everything against her. So it seems like their strategy of identity pandering is actually working pretty well. And all they would have to, I mean, so if they ever actually bothered to try to reach out to the American working class again, which they could do simultaneously, because it seems highly doubtful that very many of the other groups in the Democratic coalition are really going to be peeled off by the Green Party. When push comes to shove, they come back to the Democrats. All they have to do is reach out one small hand to the American working class to get them, and they can't bring themselves to do it. But my point is, even without doing it, they still seem absolutely dominant. So why would they?
Dominant in the party or dominant in the country? They're certainly not dominant in the country. I don't see that.
But the thing is, you were saying we're on a razor's edge, right? So in other words, they've already got nearly half the country even before they're out of the gate. And then you have a highly unpopular Republican in office. They're doing all this without making an explicit appeal to the working class.
Well, I think that that's a static analysis. It sort of says that you can lock in what Hillary got in 2016 and build from there. And what I'm saying is that the country is in a state of political flux, and that isn't going to happen. But the other factor is that the identity politics constituencies of the Democratic Party are going to make it very, very difficult for the Democratic candidate, using the old status quo politics, just to attempt to meld or graft some kind of outreach to the white working class upon the identity politics, because those constituencies of identity politics have become very riled up, and they don't want to hear it. There's a lot of anti-white sentiment among those people. I mean, you know, think about this. You know, Jesse Jackson, you think about the Rainbow Coalition. Remember when he ran in 1964 and 1968, talked about the Rainbow Coalition. I covered him a little bit. I was a political reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
And, do you mean 1984 and 88?
Oh, did I say 64?
Yeah.
I get confused on decades because I've been around so long. But 84 and 88. So think about this coalition that he's talking about. It didn't really raise many eyebrows, but it's very significant. It included blacks, browns, yellows, reds, and women. So the Rainbow Coalition is basically everybody in America except for one group, white men. And who cared? I mean, you know, white men didn't seem like they had to worry about it very much. They didn't see it as a threat. But by 2016, these white men, especially if they're in the working class or sort of middle class, saw themselves as extremely beleaguered, and they were. And they understood what this was all about. So I don't think the Democratic Party that's going to be a Democratic Party that's going to be based on the old constituencies, identity politics, is going to get very far in the primaries in 2020. And if they try it, it's going to be increasingly difficult for them. But I still believe that presidential politics are essentially based on referendums, which is a product of the performance of the incumbent or the incumbent party. And so if Trump falters and fails, I think the Democratic Party will win whatever it puts together.
What does success look like for Trump?
Well, I think that he's going to have to show that he can get legislation through that's going to affect people's daily lives. I think he's going to have to get some significant economic growth going, which we hadn't had under 8 years of Obama. He's going to have to address the needs and concerns of the working class Americans. His policies are going to have positive results. You can say, okay, he's got a different view on trade. Fine. You know, William McKinley had a different view on trade, but economic growth during his time was tremendous. So it's possible, but it's got to work, and he's got to make it work. And that's where the hard part comes. You know, Obama never really quite made it work. He made it work maybe to some mild extent in his first term. Same with George W. Bush. The problems of the Bush presidency hadn't, the chickens carrying those problems hadn't come home to roost by the time he faced the voters for re-election in 2004, but they came home to roost big time by 2008. And so there was no Republican that was going to beat any Democrat in 2008 because that term was such a disaster.
What do you think Trump's prospects of success are? I mean, you say in your article that he looks to be headed for failure, but there are other cases of presidents who turn things around. Obviously, we all know he's saddled by these Russia investigations, and he's got, you know, people in his own party who aren't super thrilled with him. We see these headlines on Drudge about Pence, who looks like he's trying to get his own ducks in a row. He's got all kinds of problems, and then he has self-inflicted problems. What do you think he would need to do? What would be a sign to you that he's getting serious and things are going to change?
Well, I think the first thing is you'd have to see a significant ending of some of the self-inflicted wounds. I think that the tweets that he puts out, many of them are not helpful to him at all. He's going to have to stop doing that. He's going to have to continue to do like what he did during his Warsaw speech, where he talks in very broad and very eloquent terms on very major matters that are facing the country. And he'll take a lot of heat for it, but I don't think that's going to hurt him at all. But more than that, he's going to have to get a handle on the government, which he doesn't have right now. He's going to have to get a handle on Congress, which he doesn't have right now. And I don't know what that means, but it means that he's going to have to do whatever he has to do in order to get legislation that is going to conceivably move the country forward, generate economic growth. And then I also think he's going to have to move the country away from some of the trajectories we're on right now that are leading to increasingly turbulent times in foreign policy. And he wants to establish a closer relationship with Russia. I endorse that. I think he should. But it's very difficult for him because of this investigation, this whole series of investigations. But we've also got this relationship with Iran. He's got people around him who basically see Iran as the font of all evil in the Middle East. I think that's wrong, and that can be very dangerous. He's got this awful Korea situation, which I don't even pretend to have an idea of how to solve that, but it's got to be dealt with very delicately. So he's got a lot of challenges. And I wouldn't, there aren't many presidents who have sort of faced the kinds of challenges that he has. But that all that means is that he's going to have to deal with them. The great presidents did. Reagan had tremendous challenges and dealt with them brilliantly. Lincoln had huge challenges and somehow managed to get through it. So that's what great presidents do.
Well, I guess time will tell what's going to happen, but it's pretty rough. I mean, the media, the thing is, the whole thing with the media, it's true that he really does rally his base when he fights back against them. But I wonder, what really matters for Trump, as for any president in this divided America, is the state of opinion of the independents. And I'm not so sure how independent voters feel about such a confrontational president with the media. I mean, to me, that's his best quality, but I'm not the typical independent voter, so to speak.
Well, on Inauguration Day, his approval rating among independents was 42%, and right now it's fluctuating between 31 and 34%, and that's devastating. He can't sustain that. He's going to have to conduct himself in ways and show success sufficiently that he brings those people back towards him, and he's going to have to get more than 42% among independents if he wants to be reelected.
Well, I'm going to recommend that people check out your piece, What If Trump Fails? I've linked to it at tomwoods.com/949. Tell me about, before we wrap up for today, tell me about your position with the American Conservative magazine, and tell me about the magazine a bit, because you are a relatively recent addition to the magazine.
Yeah, I became editor of the American Conservative in November. I was on the board, and the organization found itself without an editor, and they asked me to take over. I was very pleased to do it. I'd actually retired from Washington. I'd spent 40 years here working for the Wall Street Journal, covering politics and Congress and the White House and many other things. And then I was a executive, including CEO of Congressional Quarterly for 22 years. And then my company, CQ, got sold to The Economist of London, and I was promptly unhorsed. And so I was editor of the National Interest magazine for a couple of years. And then I sought retirement. I moved out to the Northwest, where I grew up, but built a retirement home on Puget Sound. but kept a condo in Washington because I love it here. I get my excitement in Washington and my serenity in Washington State. I'm now kind of commuting and running the American Conservative. I will say this about the magazine. I'm very proud of it, and I've been a great admirer of it for a long time. My predecessor, Dan McCarthy, was a brilliant editor. And what we try to do is, number one, we look at foreign policy from a conservative perspective that believes in realism and restraint, not the neocon idea that we need to go out into the world in search of monsters to destroy and remake countries in our own image and supplant our cultural sensibilities over those of the indigenous populations, as we did in Iraq, for example. And as, in fact, we're trying to do in Afghanistan. We're against that. We're very much against what we call crony capitalism, or the idea that government enters into cozy relationships with business. And so we rail against that. Beyond that, we try to be a big tent for conservatives, traditional conservatives, and libertarians and religious conservatives and others who are interested in the preservation of our Western heritage and our Western ideals. So that's what we stand for. And our motto, which I'm also very proud of, I can't claim any authorship of it, but it's ideas over ideology and principles over party. So we stand as an independent conservative voice.
Well, the website, of course, is theamericanconservative.com. People can check it out. And, of course, as I say, your article I'm linking to specifically at tomwoods.com/949. Well, thanks, Bob, and continued good luck with the magazine.
Tom, thank you so much. It's a pleasure being with you.
All right, everybody. Here's an interesting site to bring to your attention. Here's a site from Pat McGeehan, who is a West Virginia legislator. And you're going to want to hear about this because it's a very interesting story. Pat spent his first 2 years in the legislature frustrated, angry, and discouraged. He took a 2-year break where he discovered the philosophy of stoicism, and he applied it to his life. He went back to the West Virginia legislature and applied stoicism. And he wound up going from the lone no vote to creating a Liberty caucus and even getting kicked out of the Republican caucus. And according to his book, by applying advice he developed from stoicism, he's been integral to defeating forced pooling, passing medical marijuana, passing constitutional carry, repealing Common Core, defeating a tax increase, stopping drug war laws, removing nonviolent felonies from criminal records, cutting the budget, and protecting speech. And these are all laws that would otherwise have breezed through with bipartisan support. So he wrote a book called Stoicism and the Statehouse, to provide perspective and advice to liberty politicians and activists, though the advice pretty much goes well with anyone living a principled life, according to people who have read it. Ron Paul gives it a shining endorsement. So check out stoicismandthestatehouse.com. Pat's a good man, and I think you'll be interested to find out more about him. So stoicismandthestatehouse.com is the listener website mentioned for today. And get yourself some nice publicity like this and many other really great benefits that are going to give you an unfair advantage out of the gate if you're intending to start a website. So before you even start it, check out tomwoods.com/publicity for all your neat benefits. And I just redid the little step-by-step video that I have up there because the old one had gone out of date, so I made a brand new one for you over at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, that's it for today. See you later.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.